All right. Well, hello and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. My name is Greg Rogers with Securing America's Future Energy, and I have my co-host here.
Pete Gould with Shared Mobility Strategies.
And as always, views are our own, and our Greg Rogers...
ripped from someone else on Twitter.
Exactly. Sorry, Nathaniel Horadam.
Absolutely.
We are not sorry, Nathaniel Horadam. Well, great. Today, we are once again at the Automated Vehicle Symposium in Orlando, Florida, working on our TANs. Not as much, actually. We've been in this recording
room. Strong lighting in this room that we've hauled ourselves up.
But we're excited to be joined by...
Speaking of TANs,
we brought in some sunny personalities to join us. We have Grayson Brulte, the co-founder and president of Brulte & Co., and Mike Scrutato, who is the strategic innovation leader at Munich Re. So welcome, guys. Thanks for joining.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Mike, let's start with you. Could you give us a little background on Munich Re?
Yeah, Munich Re is one of the world's largest insurance organizations. We operate in globally around the world in both insurance and reinsurance. My focus is on how does Munich Re help enable the future of mobility through new insurance risk management products, services, and business models.
Great. And Grayson, what's your background?
My background's an interesting background. I started my career in the music business.
And you did?
Yeah. And so had a really great rock and roll time and then transitioned into mobility, because what I was able to see in the music business was with the coming of the loss of ownership of music and towards the subscription to music. And I'm starting to see that same trend with mobility. And I was like, okay, I take everything I learned in the music business around brands, the value of brands, the value of content, and then making it a subscription and starting to see that same thing in mobility. So how do you take with the music industry to mobility, because it's just another industry going through that disruption.
And who would be the Napster of mobility then?
Napster mobility. The sad part is there's going to be a lot of Napsters of mobility. It's not just one. And the funny thing is, when I was working, I was at a major record label, and I was advocating.
Bad Boy, right?
They're good people. I was advocating that the label should put a consortium together to buy Napster, because Napster was the greatest gift ever to the record industry that Steve Jobs took and ran with.
I just listened to the Walter Isaacson Steve Jobs biography, and this section was fascinating to me.
Because what Napster did, Napster opened up the back catalog. All of a sudden, there would be these songs recorded in the 50s, 60s, or even going back into the big band era. And you're kind of like, oh, this is really interesting. And then you're more inclined to go in the back catalog. Mm-hmm. And it opened up that opportunity for when iTunes came around. And it was, don't forget, when iTunes, when they rolled it out, 99 cents a song was very controversial. And the interesting thing about that partnership when they announced it was Pepsi was the original iTunes launch partner. So remember in the old days when you could open a soda and they'd have like a redeem code?
Yeah, that's right.
That was to get an iTunes credit to start that whole thing. And it's just, you have a consumer brand coming together with a technology brand that was not the trillion-dollar company it is today. It was this struggling brand that was coming, you know, out of this very dark days.
And I remember the Starbucks cards that you could get, and they would have the code for a song.
Code. Yeah.
Right.
Well, but and it's interesting because not only was the 99 cents the kind of scandalous part, it was the per song part that you no longer had to buy all the other 10 crappy songs on that album just to get the radio hit. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing, you know, is that the analogy here plays out pretty well to, instead of buying the $30,000 car, I just want to ride in it. And so that's where that breakdown, and the folks who have made have really well entrenched themselves in selling you a $30,000 car are going to be resistant to, you know, to a Napster, which, you know, I guess you could say would be a TNC or a Waymo if in the future type
right.
thing.
And it's not so much as it's not as much like a la carte sort of music. It's more like it turned into this buffet, the smorgasbord that we saw with sort of Spotify, right? And the same way with Moss, we're also talking about this eventually coming to the smorgasbord of mobility, I would imagine.
Well, if you think about it, and where has iTunes evolved to? It's to Spotify. It's music on demand. Mm-hmm. You know, how are we going to get to mobility on demand? You know, that's right. The vision. You know, we're not there yet. I think it's to say we're in the Napster era of mobility. Is pretty interesting.
Yeah, and it's funny, if taking a step back and if you look at the poster child for the albums, it was Shaggy had that album with Boombastic on it, Reggae Fantastic. Yeah. And it was that was that one radio hit that everybody wanted, and they only packaged it for $17 on the CD, and it's like, well, I can have that one song. And so
there were several good songs on that album, but I
to each their own.
Wasn't me on that one?
It wasn't me. Love me. Go on.
We found our
own. We divert.
Now we're going down the music rabbit hole. But it's really interesting. So one minute you could be listening to Shaggy, another minute you could say, well, now I want to listen to Chopin. Or I want to go listen to Al Green. So you're as your mood changes, and now in the old days you had to get out the CD and put it in, or buy the whole thing. And when iTunes came around, you can just download it and build a playlist instead of, or the old days when we had the tape recorders and we made mixes. And it's kind of interesting, as Mike said, is when you looked at Spotify, and now you can just say, oh, I'm in the mood for let's play Harvest Moon by Neil Young, or let's go to Dark Side of the Moon with Pink Floyd. So your mood kind of changes with that. And as you look at mobility, and if you're going to the grocery store, you might want to summon an autonomous vehicle that has a larger area to put your groceries in. But if you're going out to dinner with your wife, you might want to get the convertible. And so it's kind of like as your mood changes, like music, your mobility will change. And it really goes into the whole notion of brands as a subscription. And I believe in the future that consumers will subscribe to brands. And you're seeing it now with Amazon. You subscribe for Bounty paper towels. You subscribe to Tide, and it's constantly there. You're subscribing to that brand, and that brand's ingrained. It's like, oh, Tide, oh, that's really good. And the same thing's going to happen in mobility. You're going to subscribe to a brand, not necessarily a car brand, but a brand. And depending on what you want, you'll just summon that vehicle for that occasion. And that's just going to open up this incredible revenue stream. While you'll start to see some of the cannibalization from car sales early on, look at the long-term sales growth. And looking back at music, oh, Napster's killing us. It's not this. Oh, the music industry. And I was working there then. Oh, we're going through this thing. The heydays are over. I remember this when I was going to the interview. Oh, you don't want to be here. The industry's dead. Go find something new. Well, guess what? It's more profitable now than it's ever been because of streaming. And you're going to see the same thing happen in mobility.
But I think it's important to see what we're talking about here in music is a 20-year journey. It's hard to believe Napster was 20-something years ago.
Wow.
And... Yeah, you feel old, right?
Yeah.
That can't be. I was in high school. Oh, right.
No.
Man, life comes at you fast.
And, so I think when we're looking at how do we get there for mobility, I think people want to say, oh, suddenly we're going to click our heels and this magical new world's going to appear. I think it's in a similar 20-type-year journey around mobility as to how do we get there, and it's going to evolve over time, much in the way as we've talked. Music's evolved over, 20-year period.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you talk about how music evolved is that there's the issue of trust that comes up. So when you're going to a concert to see your favorite band, you trust that they're going to put a good show on.
Right.
And that same level of trust and experience will go into mobility. So when you and your wife go out to dinner and you summon the convertible autonomous vehicle, you're going to trust that the vehicle's going to be there on time, that it's going to be clean, and that it's going to get you there safely. And that same level of trust that you have and that you trust that you're going to have a great experience is going to happen in mobility. And it's going to be really interesting when you look and you contrast these worlds, because the roadmap for mobility, less than the music industry.
Right.
It's just you have to follow the patterns in history to see how we're going to get there.
And so brands are important in, obviously, in vehicles. You want to get the Porsche, you want to get the Bugatti, you want to get things that communicate sort of status, right? But you also want that reliability too, which is why Volvo, is known for being one of the safest cars in the world, right? And it's something they build their brand on. But in terms, I guess these won't be car brands that you're suggesting, right? Is this going to be like Uber? Is it going to be like Turo doing this? I mean, how do you sort of see this coming through?
You're going to see a divide in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. I believe that you will see high-end luxury brands that are offering services. They'll work with contract manufacturers, and they'll build the interiors, and they'll focus on that, and they'll operate those as services in limited geographic markets. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting if you look at the recent investments and acquisitions that the Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy Corporation has made. They're going all in on mobility, but yet the market hasn't priced it in yet. So they recently acquired Belmond Hotels. So Belmont owns some of the world's most iconic hotels. They own the Cipriani in Venice. They own the 21 Club in New York. So they have like, these really great brands. And don't forget, they own the Orient Express trains, the famous ones from Agatha Christie. And you look at that, and so you say, okay, I'm Louis Vuitton, I'm vertically integrated, and I also own the Cheval Blanc hotels as well.
Right.
And now you start saying, well, I'm a vertically integrated luxury company. I own Dom Perignon. I own all these really great liquor assets. And if we're at a level 5 vehicle and there's no driver, I can put those products in the car. And oh, by the way, I'm Bernard Arnault, the CEO and chairman of Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy. And what's the one thing I wanted more in life that I could never buy? I wanted to buy Hermès. I wanted the iconic Birkin bag under the LVMH umbrella. Well, due to proxy fights and everything and regulations in France, he was unable to acquire Hermès. But if Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy launches an autonomous vehicle, he can have one of his artists create the IT bag, the new, let's call it Birkin 2.0, that's only available in one of their vehicles if you're staying at one of their properties. And now suddenly, now you have the brand that always escapes you.
So I think that's one use case, is the brand. You know, the other use case is for the person who doesn't have access to mobility today.
Right.
Yeah. And has access to it tomorrow.
Or as Jay-Z says, you know, your chick shop at the mall. That kind of person.
You know, so I think there's a segment of consumer that brands certainly do matter for.
Yeah.
There's others, they just want to get to work or get to school or get, you know, have access to something that they might not have today. You know, and who's, you know, going to deliver that to them? You know, is it a car maker? Is that Uber? Is that their public transit? You know, and I think that's the interesting part, to see who's going to fill these different types of needs. Mm-hmm. And, but even for those people trying to get there, they're going to look to trust, you know, the availability of the service, the safety of the service, the reliability of the service. And I think that's where, you know, some type of brand or some type of service, you know, matters.
And how do you build that trust? I mean, is it just constant exposure and visibility? I mean, what does it take?
You know, I think some of it is understanding and getting people comfortable with having exposure to the technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's one. You know, you ask consumers today, are they comfortable? Do they trust autonomous vehicles? And the vast majority of Americans still don't. But I would argue that the vast majority of Americans have never seen or experienced
autonomous
vehicle.
Yeah, they can't even see one.
Yeah. How do you trust something that doesn't exist?
I don't trust my grandchildren because I've never.
No, and I know that's, you know, Grayson's involved with some of the SAE demo days.
You know,
trying to change that. You know,
right.
So it's one aspect of it is just giving people some hands-on experience with that.
Yeah, because the public has to experience the technology, and they read something in the newspaper or see something on the news, but yet they don't necessarily have an understanding of the technology, of how it's going to impact their life. And but putting the individuals in the vehicle and allowing them to ask questions of experts and experience it has changed their lives. It was 2 months ago in Detroit, SAE did a demo day, and we had a couple drive 590 miles just to go for a ride in an autonomous vehicle because they said, I see this on the news, I'm really interested, nobody's willing to put me in the car, and you're here, and I really want to be a part of this.
How do we scale the SAE demo day concept? I mean, how is this at the county fair? And, you know, with these things are not cheap. How do we get this to, you know, is it waiting until there's a mass service that's doing it on a deployment, or in the net, you know, how do we, I guess that's the question, how do we scale this to the county fair level so that you don't have to drive 600 miles?
You scale it with partnerships, with states, local municipalities, and the private sector, and say, listen, we want to sit here and have an open conversation. We want to understand the needs and the wants of your community and how this technology will have a positive impact on your community, and what are the mobility deserts in your community? Are you living in a rural community where the hospital's 50 miles away? That's a really interesting problem to solve for. How can we get them there? And so can we build a trust by going into that community and allowing those elderly individuals that might need more medical care than our regular annual physicals, say, look, the vehicle will take you, this is how it's going to work, to start to get them accustomed to it? That becomes really, really interesting. And it's going to be a variety of partnerships, and I think that once we as a society figure out trust around autonomous vehicles, you will unleash an economic boom. that we have not seen since the Industrial Revolution. But the only way to get there is with trust.
Do you think that that it's a matter of that, as if we can just get these in, as everyone to take a ride in one, then everyone will trust it? Or is the technology fully trustworthy yet?
It's not just the rides. You need to show the public, and you need to show the policymakers that we've gone through the technology to understand that it's safe. And a third-party validator is something that's going to be, you know, critical, as Senator Brandis said. Mm-hmm. It's, think about it, if you look at, going back to the consumer brands, you buy a refrigerator, I'm the guy that's looking for the Energy Star sticker. Am I going to save money on this appliance? And it's completely changed my behavior. So imagine as these vehicles are scaled and there's a sticker on there that says, oh, this met XYZ criteria, it's been deemed safe. And that's really interesting. You see it on the rental cars. I think the third-party validation, especially in the early days as we go through this transition from human-driven to autonomy, is going to be vitally, critically important.
I was going to say, one big element, too, as going back to the kind of unbundling of the single large asset purchase into a mobility kind of platform, the iTunes, the Spotify equivalent, how does the insurance switch on that? How does it go from insuring person and car and location into person, provider, specific trip? How do you unbundle the insurance policy?
Yeah, great question. You know, so one of the reasons Munich Re is involved in autonomous vehicles and the future of mobility is the fact that you're taking this business model of people owning and driving their own vehicles that you're insuring. And as that business model evolves, so do the insurance products. And we want to make sure that insurance doesn't remain a barrier for this. A couple of years ago, when we first started coming to AVS, it was a great talking point of insurance as a barrier to the deployment of autonomous vehicles. And we had a great answer for that. It's not a barrier because Munich Re.
You can insure anything.
Munich Re has an insurance product for autonomous vehicles, so how can it be a barrier? And our insurance products will evolve as the technology, as the business models evolve. And you're seeing the insurance industry step up and develop insurance products for these new mobility models. And insurance is part of the trust equation, but we don't think it's the entire answer, because insurance is not a promise that nothing will ever go wrong. Mm-hmm. Insurance is a promise to pay when things go wrong. You know, every vehicle that's on the road today is insured. There are still 40,000 people killed a year mm-hmm. in vehicle crashes. Mm-hmm. So what we are looking to do at Munich Re, in addition to deploying insurance products for these, this week here we've announced a Verified, which is a service that Munich Re is piloting to help build trust in autonomous vehicles through a third-party verification or a third-party audit of autonomous vehicle manufacturers. Are they doing what they are saying they're doing? You know, so this is not an audit against a third-party standard or something that's required by some regulator, but it is something
it's basically, are you full of shit? In your VSSA, that's great. You copied the Waymo one. We showed up at your plant or your test site, and you guys aren't doing any of that. Is that what you're saying?
We're saying we're substantiating what people are saying. VSSAs. But it's to add a level of transparency to statements manufacturers are making about themselves. And we think this is the first step toward adding to trust, adding to transparency, to help making other stakeholders in the autonomous vehicle ecosystem comfortable with this technology.
And so you're not picking metrics. You're not saying we've done an audit of your data and you actually, here's how many, you know, disengagements per mile. You're saying, here's what you told us you were doing, and we've certified or not certified that you actually are.
Yeah, we don't think, you know, we've talked to a lot of people in the industry about this concept, and we don't think the industry is ready for metrics yet. It's not mature enough. You know, there probably will come a point in time where, yes, you can create metrics, you can benchmark against each other. But right now, we believe the first step toward transparency is just validating people are doing what they're claiming in their VSSAs or other types of public statements. We had a discussion here this morning with a public transit agency that's going through the process where they want to bring these vehicles into their community. Mm-hmm. And they're struggling as to what questions to ask. They're bringing providers in. Providers are giving them these really great presentations, but
hitting all the right words and
But if you're, you know, if you're a public transit agency that's new to this, how do you know how to measure one against the other or validate, you know, what you're seeing in a pitch or an RFP response? So we think this is a solution that will help shine the light on people that are doing it the right way. You know, it's something that manufacturers can volunteer to do, that they're, no one's telling them that they have to do this. And by promoting and letting people know these are the companies doing it the right way, it raises the boat for the whole industry. And then we think helps accelerate the adoption of best practices, of standards. And it's like I said with our insurance products, you know, it's, they'll evolve as the technology, as the business models evolve. Same thing with trust. I mean, we're not claiming this is the ultimate answer for trust.
I love this. This is a great idea.
So for where the industry is today, we think this is a great way to advance the trust discussion. Because, you know, what we've seen is it's not black and white between self-certification and some type of federally mandated, you know, regulation. Right. We think there's a big gray area in between those two, and we're trying to say, let's take the step, a first step forward in building transparency.
And it's a road to getting those standards too. I mean, this is not going to happen overnight. In terms of partners, who have you sort of are you looking to partner with auto companies or AV developers on this initially? Or
so right now, we're we're piloting with a couple AV developers companies. You know, we've not disclosed any of the partnerships yet, but it'll, you know, we'll be auditing those making and deploying the vehicles. We'll also have some tech partners. I mean, Munich Re is a insurance, we're risk management expertise. You know, we can design risk management frameworks and help assess risk. You know, we're not the technical experts, so we're bringing, you know, some technical partners to help in some of these audits. And as this evolves, you know, we'll be announcing more, but, you know, our purpose here this week is just let the world know we're willing to do this.
It sounds like a great thing too, for the ones who are doing it right, and then seeing a lot of other folks all making the same claims and having even just a strong gut suspicion that I don't actually think you're really doing all of that. You just saw that we were saying it. I think that it's probably, I would hope that you're going to have some of the best actors leap to take you up on this to create a little bit of peer pressure for the others who are also making similar claims.
Yeah, it's peer pressure and it's best practices.
Yeah.
You know, because look, everyone is learning, everyone's going through their own development process. And we think by taking this step, it allows people to promote what they're doing without having to disclose their intellectual property. You know, like the big, you know, problem, a lot of people just ask for lots of data only because they don't know what else to ask for. You know, to do this, we don't necessarily need lots of data. We just need to see. Yeah,
I thought insurance companies just wanted all the data.
But this is a service that we're doing. You know, it's risk managed. It's a risk managed service. It's not an insurance product. You know, so we don't necessarily need the insurance, the data to price a risk. We're substantiating companies are doing, and you know, this is a new service for Munich Re that's separate from the insurance that we're doing.
Will it factor into the pricing of an insurance to then insure someone?
Down the road, possibly, but right now this is a separate fee service from our insurance policies.
Grayson,
and it's interesting what Mike said and Pete, you said is that with risk management, and so like earlier we talked about like the Louis Vuitton brand, if the executive board is going to make the decision to put that brand on a vehicle, there needs to be some sort of risk management, because while we had an incident with another AV company, that brand's value is a microcosm of what the Louis Vuitton brand is worth. And if you had a risky situation where you're going to put a brand, a household brand like that on a car, you have to ensure that all like the risk has been completely mitigated. And there's no better person or organization than an insurance company. So as one of these brands, Louis Vuitton, is looking to deploy an autonomous vehicle service, the first thing that they're going to do is like, okay, what is our brand exposure risk? Not necessarily what is our financial exposure risk. What is the negative possible impact to the brand if something happens?
And what's the most reputable company we can partner with on doing this to make sure we're maintaining it?
Yeah, like if you Louis Vuitton partnering with Munich Re, they're lowering their risk and putting all the safety guards in place so their business can continue to prosper and to expand. It's that when and we'll go back in the history thing here, is when there was the big, luxury was one of the last markets to fully embrace e-commerce. There was all the concern about, oh, brand devaluation with selling a luxury good online. Mm-hmm. Oh, what if the credit card gets stolen? We can't give them that bespoke customer service that they're used to. There was risk, and they had to do risk mitigation for that. Mm-hmm. And the same type of similar risk mitigation will have to happen when they transform from e-commerce to in autonomous vehicle car commerce. Mm-hmm. And it's just these patterns that are evolving. And just, you have to limit risk in every which way, and then they have to go to their shareholders and say, look, we've developed this trust with the technology, we've vetted everything, so now we're fully comfortable selling, putting our name on this product and selling our products in that car because we know that we've mitigated the risk at all costs.
Mm-hmm. And so do you see is an opportunity to sort of showcase products? I'm kind of imagining, you have this hotel chain, you have sort of this luxury chain, and you get off at the airport and your luxury AV pulls you up, right? Are you envisioning some sort of like smaller shopping experience within the vehicle? I mean,
it's interesting.
It'll be better than the magazines and the airplanes, right?
it'll be much better than your current travel experience in a ground vehicle or on an airplane. And as it relates to hotels, so the hotels, the general metric is RevPAR, revenue per available room. And the one thing the hotels want more than anything, they want to know your check-in time and your check-out time so they can optimize their room inventory. Mm-hmm. And right now when you're traveling and you're picked up at an airport by a livery service that's going to the hotel, they're outsourcing that. And then they have no control of that experience. So in the future, when you arrive at the airport, Pete or Greg or Mike, and it says, okay, Greg, go to spot one, Pete, go to spot two, Mike, go to spot three. You get in your autonomous vehicle, and let's say it's the Peninsula brand or Four Seasons brand or Acme Hotel brand, and you get in there. They know you're in the vehicle, the temperatures that you have, your water, whatever you might want to get. You have that whole experience in the car already, and they know when you're arriving, and they can greet you. And then if you take that one step further, so that's just your traditional luxury hotel. One of the greatest beneficiaries, and we're in the great state of Florida, and being here in Orlando is Mickey Mouse. Mm-hmm. And then there's Mickey Mouse, and then there's Star Wars. And so imagine if you're a big Star Wars fan, and we're seeing what's happening in Disneyland right now, the lines with the pre-ticketing, and it's just been this astronomical boom, and you can make the argument that Bob Iger is one of the greatest CEOs in history just for the acquisitions of Pixar and Lucas and film. And so when you land as a Star Wars fan and you fly from D.C. and you land at MCO, which somebody told me is a really cute story, stands for Mickey's Corporate Office, and you land there, you have a generic autonomous vehicle will pick you up. But then when you get inside the vehicle, it knows your favorite Star Wars character, your favorite Star Wars scene.
The Millennium Falcon. Chewbacca gets projected next to me.
And you're in the Millennium Falcon, and you're flying to the Star Wars Hotel here in Disney World. And the great part about it is so when you're landing on one of those worlds at the new hotel, you're going to be completely enclosed in that environment. So you'll never actually see the outside. Mm-hmm. And so you start living that experience. And think about that. When you're living that experience as a fan of Star Wars, that's incredible. You're like, this is the coolest thing. Right. And it ties into the Instagram culture. You're going to Instagram the bejabbers out.
Oh, you bet.
This is the greatest thing in the world. From Disney's perspective, they're able to upsell you a service because, oh, I got to take the Millennium Falcon. But the one thing in order that Disney needs to deliver that service to you, they need you to trust them. Because if you look back at the origins of Walt Disney and the way that Walt built the company, Walt built the company with Roy on the single thing of trust. They were burnt. Oswald was basically stolen from them by Universal, and there was a lot of really interesting things that happened then. But there's a very famous story where there was one of the original animators who started swearing in a meeting, and Walt fired him and said, you can't do that. That devalues our brand. Huh. And it's incredible if you read his biography, the amount of attention and detail that they put to protecting that brand. Mm. And as a parent, when I take my daughter to Disneyland or Disney World, there's one thing I know. I can trust that there will not be something inappropriate that she'll see, and there'll be that environment. So it's like a welcoming environment. So what we have to get to as an industry is when you as an individual get into that autonomous vehicle, you have to have that feeling as when I'm a dad walking into Disney World that I trust that it's going to be safe and we're going to have a good time. Mm-hmm. If we can achieve that as a society when you get into that vehicle,
right,
something very special is going to happen.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So look, I'm thrilled about the idea of getting in my Millennium Falcon and going to Disneyland, and this thrills me, right? Being able to afford going to a luxury hotel and getting this really customized ride. But my concern is that what if this just ends up perpetuating these sort of silos of transportation we already have, single occupancy vehicles? If, you know, only one person is maybe going to the Ritz-Carlton after they land, that's not incentivizing pooled rides, which are part of the promise of AVs. Have you given thought to like what the challenges there might be?
Well, the challenge is there's different services for different types of environments. If you're going on a vacation, you're going on a vacation to have a wonderful experience.
Right.
I mean, that's really what it's looking for. But if you're living in a dense urban environment like New York City, the shared rides make a ton of sense.
Right.
And you want to get from point A to point B efficiently and safely and cheaply as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really going to depend on what you're trying to achieve and where it's going in the environment.
Right, it's not the daily commute that you're doing this for, right?
You know, I think where it makes sense, where it adds value, mm-hmm. the shared ride will happen. You know, I was struck by this earlier in the year. I was in Detroit for the auto show mm-hmm. in January, and the Detroit People Mover was packed because it served a need,
mm-hmm.
and it got people from their hotel to the convention center mm-hmm. in January in Detroit, quickly, cheaply, and efficiently, more so than an Uber, more so than walking, more so than driving.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Detroit People Mover, outside of that 1 week, is virtually empty.
Right.
But for that 1 week, it serves a purpose and it adds value to the consumer experience. So how do you create mobility platforms that add value to people and encourage them to share rides?
Right.
That's, I think, the question that the idea of the mobility platform hasn't answered yet,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's about that. I think people are willing to share a ride if it's helping them get to where they need to be as mm-hmm. fast, efficient, safely as possible.
I agree. And we talk a lot about there where rather than having the public sector focusing on subsidizing cost of trips, that subsidizing time, I think, is more important. Making making it more efficient to do what we want you to do is the answer, rather than trying to either punish you for doing what we don't want you to do or trying to make it free but still inconvenient to do something that you necessarily aren't initially inclined. I want to go back on the brand thing. So even in the whether it's the Louis Vuitton or the Disney example, why does that have to be them operating the system? So it sounds like what you're describing to me is what I'm imagining the Apple Car would be, which can be either a lower end, nice, but a lower end, or a super high end. But that when you get in is basically wall to wall of screens, and at which point it is a media sales is the real moneymaker there. And so that same Apple vehicle in coming from MCO to Disney is giving you the full Disney experience. In New York, it's giving you, the Times Square, Broadway kind of pitch. And it's basically advertising. It's just it's kind of a Minority Report style thing. I'm curious why you think that the brands are actually going to operate it too.
Licensing rights, intellectual property. Disney owns the intellectual property to Lucasfilm. They can do things with that property that Apple couldn't do. They maybe have a licensing deal, but they can't build an entire experience from the ground up. And if you wanted to go in the Apple Car, okay, that's fine. You can, watch it or stream the Star Wars movie, download it on iTunes. But if you go in the Disney version, you can have something exclusive because they own the IP to that rights that you couldn't have. Or maybe randomly Chewbacca is in that vehicle with you to surprise you. Or like with my daughter, if you put Minnie Mouse in that mm-hmm. vehicle.
But those all sound like TNC partnership type things, like... If you've got the service, they will make a deal with Disney for the MCO. Are you envisioning these brands, licensing the full stack, manufacturing vehicles, or?
I think it depends on the brand and the use case. I mean, just the way today, you have luxury brands, you have middle-of-the-road brands, you have economy brands. Grayson's talking about luxury brands and people on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just getting people to work, getting children to school, you know, your daily life. You might not have Chewbacca and the Millennium Falcon. You might be encouraging shared rides, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a different type of brand, a different type of trust, a different type of experience here. And I think, you know, I agree with you, Grayson, brands will matter. I don't think there's going to be just this utilitarian, we're all using the exact same mobility platform.
No, I don't think it's a commodity.
But I think it very much will vary based on, are you on vacation? Mm-hmm. Are you looking for this special experience? Or are you just trying to get to work? Or are you just trying to get to school? Or have your kid picked up somewhere?
Yeah. Right.
You're 100% right. It will vary. And you mentioned public transportation earlier, and I think it's really important when we look at that, and it's how it's highly inefficient, and where there's all these jobs that are available, but they're not near public transportation. So then imagine when that individual can go to that job and they can get a shared autonomous ride, and it's half the price of public transportation, they can get a higher paying job. Mm-hmm. That changes somebody's life. Or imagine when a child can go to a better charter school because the autonomous vehicle can take them there, and then the mom can get a notification or the dad can get a notification. Hi, child has arrived at school, unlock doors. Mm-hmm. And think about all the bright futures. Well, I pontificated on luxury brands and travel experiences. The greatest beneficiary of autonomy is going to be those individuals that are less fortunate, mm-hmm. that really need autonomy. And if you think about, like, if there's a single mother, I think about this a lot, there's a single mother living in Los Angeles, and she's did really good and won the lottery and got her kids into a charter school, or it was really lucky and was able to get a scholarship to one of the private schools in LA, but then couldn't afford to take her child to kind of see the ocean, or could not afford to take her child to see Joshua Tree, they're studying the desert. Imagine that if that AV could then take that family out there to Joshua Tree to experience a desert for a day, mm-hmm. and something could click in that child's mind, the child would go on to change the world.
Right.
And today they can't do that because the cost of taking a lift out there is prohibitive. The cost of a rental car is a big hurdle because a lot of those individuals don't have the credit to get the credit card to get the rental car.
Right.
And with the autonomous vehicle, they will not need the credit check, and that could be highly subsidized. And they can get them out there, and it could just change, and they can have this wonderful family experiences and just completely change their lives.
And this is what I love is that, you know, the power of AVs to unlock opportunity. And there's this thing in the transport, this could be an entire episode, but there's this like idea in the transportation sector that we need to reduce VMT. But there's so much value in every mile that's traveled. There's some people who aren't able to move as much as they should, and as much as that will provide them with opportunities. And so that's where I think a lot of the promise is. And I really appreciate that. But I think we're coming up on time. Thank you guys for joining us. If folks want to find you online, are you on Twitter, LinkedIn, et cetera? How do we follow you?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at GBRULTE.
And I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm on Twitter at MJSDad03.
Great. And Pete?
You can find me on Twitter at SharedMobilitySS.
Great. And I am at AVGregR, follow the Mobility Podcast at Mobility Podcast. Check out our website, mobilitypodcast.com. Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and stay tuned for more great episodes from AVS. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.